Welcome to the podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. Our podcast weaves together the message and a taste of the music that we experience each Sunday morning as we root our lives in grace through worship here at The Table. More and more people are finding their way to The Table through this podcast. So if you are one of the many, many folks who tune in each week from other parts of California, other parts of our country, or even from other places in the world, we would invite you to take a next step in growing in faith here at The Table. You can do that online at our website, thetableumc.org. There you'll find links to social media and also a way to make a deep commitment to our community to express how you hope to root your life in grace, to grow in faith, to reach in love, and to give generously. If you're one of the many people listening to this but haven't quite walked through the door of the sanctuary yet on a Sunday morning, we would love to welcome you into the beauty of this sanctuary. We gather each Sunday for worship at 9:30 and at 11. Our address is 5265 H Street in East Sacramento.
As I went down to the river to pray, studying about that good old way, who shall wear a starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, brothers, let's go down, come on, brothers, let's go down, down to the river to pray. As I went down to the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear a starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, fathers, let's go down, come on, fathers, let's go down, down to the river to pray.
If you have children this morning and they're staying with us for service, there are some folders in the back, and I invite you to get those folders for the kids if you haven't already done so. Our scripture lesson this morning is found in Exodus chapter 16. The whole congregation of the Israelites set out from Elam, and Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which was between Elam and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. The whole congregation of the Israelites complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate our fill of bread. For you have brought us out into the wilderness to kill us, the whole assembly, with hunger." And then Moses said to Aaron, "Say to the whole congregation of the Israelites, draw near to the Lord, for he has heard your complaining." And as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the Israelites, they looked toward the wilderness, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them in the cloud. And the Lord spoke to Moses and said, "I've heard the complaining of the Israelites. Say to them, at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will have your fill of bread. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God. In the evening, quails came and they covered the camp. And in the morning, there was a layer of dew on the ground. And on the surface of the wilderness was a fine, flaky substance, as fine as frost on the ground. And when the Israelites saw it, they said to one another, 'What's that?' For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, 'It is the bread that the Lord has given to you to eat.' And the house of the Lord called it manna. It was like coriander seed, white, and the taste of it was like wafers made of honey. And the Israelites ate that manna for 40 years until they came to a habitable land. They ate manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan." The word of God for the people of God. Amen. Thanks be to God.
Everybody's got a pain inside. Imaginary wounds they try to hide. How can I hate them when everybody's got a pulse? I dream in a world that wants my soul, that tells me if I hate, I can control. But I don't believe it, I cannot conceive it, when everybody's got a pulse. I am human, I am love, and my heart beats with my blood. Love will always win underneath the skin. Everybody's got a pulse.
I'm going to begin with a poem. It's called Breathing Underwater, and it's by a nun whose name is Carol Bielik. I built my house by the sea, not on the sands, mind you, not on the shifting sand, and I built it of rock. A strong house by a strong sea, and we got well acquainted, the sea and I. Good neighbors, not that we spoke much. We met in silences, respectful, keeping our distance, but looking our thoughts across the fence of sand, always the fence of sand, our barrier, always the sand between. And then one day, and I still don't know how it happened, the sea came, without warning, without welcome even, not sudden and swift, but a shifting across the sand like wine, less like the flow of water than the flow of blood. Slow but coming, slow but flowing like an open wound. And I thought of flight, and I thought of drowning, and I thought of death. And while I thought, the sea crept higher, till it reached my door, and I knew then there was neither flight, nor death, nor drowning. That when the sea comes calling, you stop being neighbors, well acquainted, friendly at a distance neighbors, and you give your house for a coral castle, and you learn to breathe underwater. It struck me that the story we just heard from Exodus is what it's like to learn to breathe underwater. That's what the people of God, the Israelites, have been doing. Earlier in the story of Exodus, they were enslaved in Egypt, trapped. Pharaoh was the ruler, controlling their fate and their lives. Everything that they thought was theirs was Pharaoh's, until Moses led them to freedom, to liberation, and then Miriam led them in dancing. Their dancing was a wilderness, nothing like a gay nightclub, yet so very, very, very much like Pulse Nightclub. See, they'd recently found a sense of freedom. The wilderness, like Pulse, was a sanctuary for them. It was a place where they could just be themselves. The beautiful darkness of Pulse last weekend was shattered as bullets rained down in an instant. And bullets didn't rain down on the Israelites. It was more like water rising up slowly over their houses, the houses they were trying to build right there in the wilderness. And their dancing was cut way, way too short as that water overtook them. To be clear, at Pulse, the people dancing had absolutely nothing to do with causing the music to stop. A lone person terrorized Pulse, and he wasn't really alone at all. He was inevitably shaped by folks who use religious language, who use the name of God to justify hatred and violence in the most unimaginable of ways. Reverend Karen Oliveto, who was here earlier, just a few months ago, she's a pastor at a church called Glide in San Francisco. She says it powerfully. May we not let the music die, but sing out loud and proud, pushing back the cries of hatred and intolerance, our voices uniting in a beautiful, bold chorus of love. See, the Israelites, after becoming free, they were pushing back with cries of their own. They were uniting their voices, and their voices were being united in anger and complaint and rage. It says in Exodus 16, the Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the hands of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate our fill of bread, for you have brought us out of this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." See, they weren't ready to dance. They weren't ready to dance in freedom. They actually wanted to go back to Egypt, the place that they had been enslaved, the place where they had no freedom, the place where they had no choice about their own lives. Somehow they get out into freedom and they want to go back to these other ways. And every single addict I've ever met has told me that this is real, people. You move out of your addiction and you move into a sense of freedom, and then you get confused. You willfully forget what it was actually like. And you start to think, the vulnerability that I feel here on my own with God and the actual people around me, this is scary. It must be better back where I was. That's what the Israelites felt. They said, I can't handle this. This is how addiction functions. It always tries to bring us back to distorted views of how our lives were before we were actually free. It doesn't allow us to see the chaos of what addiction really is. And it wants us to think that the chaos of being trapped in addiction was better than the vulnerability that we find ourselves trying to learn to breathe in underwater as addicts who are in the midst of recovery. That poem by Carol Bielek, in her poem, she says that we cannot stop the drowning waters of our addictive culture from rising. We can't stop the waters from coming up. But we must at least see our reality for what it is. Seek to properly detach from it. And then build a coral castle and learn to breathe underwater. Every addict knows that this is the only way to keep on keeping on. And if you don't, the other choice is death. It's just that clear, people. The New Testament calls this salvation. 12-step programs call it recovery. The trouble is that most Christians push this great liberation off into the next world and fail to see how this is our invitation for right now, to move from the entrapments of life around us and into the freedom that God calls us to. And as I've talked with people over and over this week, the truth is that a lot of people in 12 steps settle merely into sobriety from a substance instead of really experiencing what transformation can be like to their lives as well. We're not alone in that. And the Israelites choose flight. They wanted to turn around and to head back to life that they thought might be better in Egypt, the life that they really deep down in their souls knew was nothing for them at all. But they were stuck in a cycle of addiction. And God rained down on them bread from heaven. Just enough bread to get by. Enough bread for today. And then tomorrow, enough bread for tomorrow. And on the day before the Sabbath, enough bread for both days so that you wouldn't have to break the law. You could sustain yourself in all that was before you and it would be enough. But it didn't feel like enough. So they started to hoard what was there. They started to take what was yours for mine. They got back into that same cycle of addiction. The water started to rise. They couldn't handle the structure that God had given before them. They had a way of life that was laid out before them, but it was too much. The way, see, was dependent on acknowledging that they needed God. And they couldn't handle that. They couldn't handle turning their lives over to God. They couldn't handle that structure. And in the wilderness, it's called the wilderness of sin. The Israelites preferred chaos to the way of love, the way of life that God longed for them to follow. See, their dancing turned right away to complaining and I would say even anger and rage, it's fair to say. It's the kind of rage that I felt, that I'm imagining most everyone in the room felt. If you turned on YouTube, turn on the video on YouTube and saw the pastor right here in Sacramento who didn't just condone violence, but actually celebrated it in this space. It was posted on my wall just the day after we gathered last Sunday. It was on Monday evening, and I tried to watch. Got 45, 50 seconds in. It was too much. And I tried to post right away to say that this distorted biblical analysis is nothing of God. Nothing. And to try to turn people's attention to what feels like the prophet and the preacher of our day, at least last week, was Anderson Cooper, who's standing stoically like a good journalist in front of a camera, and then the facade just falls. And as he named the actual people and said, these aren't just numbers, these are people, and he shared just parts of their lives, we got to see his humanity. We got to feel our own. See, friends, I am confident that God can handle our anger. There are protesters who are probably still there right now at that church to try to be an expression of love. And I know that God can handle whatever rage they find themselves in as they gather in that space. God is not afraid. I'm afraid for the children in that community that are being raised in this way of hatred. I'm afraid for them. I'm also afraid that the folks, many of whom from this church community are going to stand there as a prophetic witness of love, are going to get caught up in the rage. And that we're not going to fight back with love, but we're going to get stumbling, thinking that we too are going to overcome violence with violence. And I'm afraid of that. I'm honestly fearful about how we're going to do that. And so my prayer is that God is going to meet whatever rage is in our bodies right now, in the days that have passed or in the days that are ahead, and to transform that. My prayer is that's what's happening right now in Natomas. The Bible, though, never forbids our anger at injustice. The Psalms over and over and over offer people of God crying out when they feel abandoned, when they suffer, when they're in the midst of danger. Job refuses to resign himself to suffering. The whole book of Job is him railing against God. So if you've been there this week, you can know that you are not alone. You are not alone. Jesus cried out anguish, rage maybe, depending on how you read it. My God, why have you forsaken me? We come from a long tradition of people who stand up in the face of injustice and name it for what it is and cry out to God for healing and for transformation. There's a theologian from Croatia whose own life story has been shaped by civil war and violence in ways that I frankly can't fathom. And he says it this way. Miroslav Volf writes, rage belongs before God. We place both our unjust enemy and our vengeful self face to face with a God who loves and does justice. God hears the anger of the Israelites, recognizes not only their need for sustenance, the daily bread, but their desire for life beyond scarcity. And God, for the paleo folks among us, this is some good news. God says, I'm not going to allow you to be vegan out in the wilderness the whole time. We're going to send some quail among you too. God's going to provide enough for you to really eat. And if you're vegan, like, you can leave the quail for other people. But God says, I'm going to provide for you in this space. I'm going to be with you. See, this is a different kind of God than the Pharaoh had been to them in Egypt. That Pharaoh had said, I'm going to control when you get up. I'm going to control where you work and when you work. God says, I have a simple structure for you. I am going to provide what you need, and you are going to live within that structure. And we couldn't do it. We couldn't do it. And it feels to me like we can't do it very well right now. It's hard to imagine actually trusting in God in the midst of all this. And that's what we've been trying to figure out how to do these last 6 weeks together. This worship series has been about helping us to try to stay in love with God. And we focused each week on a different way that we might do this. We call these practices. One of the practices is to come here together to worship. One of the practices is what we just have done. We've prayed, witnessed. You are a witness right now by choosing to walk into this sanctuary to say that God's love is going to win. That's sharing a story of where you're placing your hope right now. Searching scripture, that's what we're in the midst of doing that. At this moment, communion, we're going to move together toward the feast of God's love. And this morning, we're going to reflect on fasting and abstinence as a way to stay in love with God. And when I first imagined this, I want to tell you, friends, I wasn't excited to talk about fasting or abstinence. I don't think any pastor has ever been excited to talk about fasting or abstinence. It's why this is the last one on the list of practices. It's because no one wants to talk about this. If you say it out loud before that this is what you're going to focus on, the pews will be empty and you might as well be talking about fasting and abstinence to yourself. Because friends, no one wants to actually live into this. And I was there just a few weeks ago. I was thinking, really? I don't want to actually do this. I've been in youth ministry with young people. And I've seen what fasting becomes. It becomes this way we try to control our bodies to try to live out this unrealistic ideal of what a body should look like, and then it becomes destructive. And every time I've taught a class up here about our kitchen tables, when we get to fasting and abstinence, I'm always like, well, fasting and abstinence, let's talk about the next thing. And we just go on to the next thing. In these last couple of weeks, friends, I've come to a totally different understanding of this. And I want to try to share a little bit of that with you. Because for me, I think I'm starting to see that fasting and abstinence might be the most important practice that we as a people of God need to spend some time in right now. We live in a culture that is absolutely and fundamentally addicted. It's a cycle of addiction. And we've got to figure out how we're going to participate in interrupting that if we're going to try to say that we're staying in love with God. For me, what's helped me a lot these last few weeks and months, honestly, is a book called Breathing Underwater, just like the poem I opened with. His name is Richard Rohr. He's a priest, and the subtitle is Spirituality in the 12 Steps. He invites us to think about fasting and abstinence, and I think it might be a beautiful and powerful thing for us to hold in the wake of all of the violence around us. He writes, "More and more I'm convinced that when the great medieval spiritual teachers talk so much about attachment, they're really talking about addiction. We are all attached and addicted in some way. At the very least, we're addicted to our compulsive, dualistic pattern of thinking. To our preferred self-image." That is an attachment I have. That's an addiction I have. "And to the unworkable programs of happiness that we developed as little kids and that shape how we move in the world. In short, each of us is addicted to our way of thinking. Each one of us. And this is perfectly obvious when we consider it, but most of us don't spend very much time considering the ways we actually think." He continues, "The healing ministry of Jesus should make this crystal clear for us. See, the majority of Jesus' work in healing is healing. Nine of Jesus' healing stories are actually exorcisms. This is why we sang the song, 'Don't Let the Devil Ride.' For a lot of people in this room, this makes us very nervous. We are way too sophisticated for Jesus to be doing any exorcism of anyone. We know that we don't need that part of the good news. That can't be for us. But friends, if we were to understand possessions by the devil, what it means to be possessed, why you would need this, it is primitive to be true, to be clear. And it feels absolutely truthful in describing what happens for a life that is overwhelmed by addiction. It's possessed. It is possessed. And I think we as a people live into that possession. Christina stood right here as sister-in-law of the pastor who shared such violence from a pulpit in Natomas last week and tried to share a message of love and hope. And when I went home to actually watch the way that first video was edited, you would think she said like 40 seconds of stuff and then everything went right back to the same pastor. And it's easy to blame it on the media, like, oh, the media is going to cause this. But the only reason the media produces this is because we seem to need it. We want more of it. And we're stuck. This is the cycle of violence that we are in. And friends, we need help. And I'm wondering this morning if the reason maybe that we need to root our lives in grace by practicing fasting and abstinence is because folks in the recovery community have a lot to teach us about how to actually follow Jesus. And that, I know, is going to feel uncomfortable to folks in the room. Because addiction is supposed to just be about alcoholics and drug addicts who can't get their stuff together. See, 12-steppers have traditionally been the people that meet upstairs at a church at night. And the people on Sunday morning, we have higher things that we're doing. We can't be bothered with the problems that the people upstairs have. But it feels like these messages are actually the same message. How are we going to allow ourselves to turn our lives over to God and to trust that God can handle whatever it is that is trapping us and can help us through that, can guide us? Richard Rohr writes that on a practical, transformational level, the gospel message of Jesus and the 12-step message of Bill W., they are largely the same. The first foundational connection is that addiction can be a metaphor for what our biblical tradition calls sin. That's what addiction is. It is sin. It's the way in which we don't allow ourselves to see what really is, and we keep falling back into a cycle of destruction. The 12 steps reconnect, and then they invite us into an actual vulnerability by abstaining from the addictions that overwhelm us, and that overwhelming vulnerability can be a new challenge for every single person that I've talked to this week who is in the process of recovery. I've listened to their stories these last weeks, and as soon as you move into a place of freedom, it is so easy to just look back and think, the vulnerability that I experienced because I am actually not on a substance right now is so hard, I cannot handle it. Whatever your addiction is, I can't handle it. So that old way must be a better way. That's what the Israelites felt. They moved into freedom and they thought, this new way of actually being together, I think I'll just take when Pharaoh used to tell me what to do. It feels like that's where we are as a people. And people in recovery have experienced the water rising up over their heads. And they've learned how to breathe underwater because they know if they don't, the only other option is death. And you can't but be at a meeting upstairs any day at this church and not know that that's true. And unfortunately, too many people that come in on Sunday morning think that that's a message for upstairs, not a message for all of us. Folks who are in recovery know that it starts with placing their trust in God. It doesn't begin with them at all. It begins with God. And then we turn our lives over to God. We trust that we cannot do this on our own, and we work steps. And then we remind ourselves we can't do this on our own, and we trust in God, and we work steps. There's no quick fix. You can't get up one morning and forget, because if you do, your train is a wreck. And whether you recognize that you have an addiction or not, I've met with way too many people just in the last couple of days. I am absolutely clear that almost every single person I've talked to in this room has something that is trapping us right now. And we're struggling. We all are. And maybe this recovering way of acknowledging that God is with us and starting there might actually just be the way of following Jesus as well. And you might think that you're not addicted to anything. That's been clear for me as I used to think this isn't important for us to talk about. But this morning, I'm convinced that our culture is absolutely addicted. And we can't escape it. The Israelite society was addicted in their day to this narrative that it was better to go back to being enslaved than to be actually free in God's love. And I'm concerned that we're addicted this day to a cycle of violence that we just don't know how to interrupt. And some of you we're trying beautifully to do it this week. You took Christina's message that she shared right here, and you pushed post on all kinds of different social media. And you said, you know what? The violence that we experience in the world is not going to have the last word. I'm going to be a witness to love and to healing. And so many people in this room said, I want to stand there. I want to root my life in love and share that message. And I know how bold that is for people that have been burned by the church to even begin to associate with that. And so many folks did just that. It feels like our challenge, if we're to stay in love with God, to root our lives in loving our neighbors, we're all going to need some serious recovery work. We're all going to need it. We're going to need to discern ways, what it looks like to abstain from this vicious cycle of violence that we find ourselves in. And for some, that means being there right now with a sign to express a love at a place and at a pastor whose message, at least to this point, and I know my life has been transformed, so I'm hopeful that his will as well. But people are there to express love. And to do that, they have to root their lives in a deep, deep journey. It can't just, see, we can go there and protest, and that itself can be superficial and self-aggrandizing. It can be superficial just like anything else that we do. The real work of learning to breathe underwater, to resist our cultural addictions to the cycle of violence, it's going to take daily commitments. And every single person that's in recovery knows this all too well. This isn't a choice. This is our only way. The Israelites experienced God raining down bread, and they said, "What is that?" And God said, "That's enough. This is a structure that I'm going to give for you. And your task is to live within it." See, God longs to repossess us. That whatever evils possess our lives right now, God longs to repossess us. And there are those in this room right now who are addicts, and they know this more deeply than most of us can imagine. Fasting and abstinence has saved their lives. They know what it's like to be in a wilderness and to try to find ways to trust in God. They've tasted manna in ways that I long for all of us to experience. One of the stories of abstinence that came to me that I want to share with you this morning. This is a creative, powerful, prophetic image of what abstinence looks like, and I want to offer it to you. When I was on study leave in Petaluma, Sarah and Eleanor and I went to worship one Sunday morning at a brand new United Methodist Church in Oakland. It's called Embrace. It started a year ago. There were 31 of us that were there. It reminded me when we used to have one service and we would be excited if there were 31 of us here 5 years ago. Their community is different than ours. It's pastored by Sam Yoon. This is Sam. They identify as a Pan-Asian community. It's mostly folks in their 20s and their 30s, and they're trying to figure out, like we are, how to root their lives in grace and grow in faith and reach in love. They call their church Embrace. And Pastor Sam received an email that every pastor, whether they admit it or not, wants to receive. Pastor Sam opened up his email, and he got an invite to a bachelor party. I can attest, folks, this never happens. No one has ever invited me to their bachelor party. No one has even thought about inviting me to their bachelor party. And Sam is in this as well, so Sam was excited. He's like, "This might be a mistake, but I'm in. This is awesome. I'm going to a bachelor party, Pastor Sam." And he's looking at it, and he's like, "I've got a bag, like Vegas. Can we go tomorrow? I'm in." And he reads down, and he's like, "Oh, they're not going to Vegas. They're going to Mexico. Cabo. I could do this. Like, this is great. I'll take that weekend off. I'm excited." And then he kept reading down, and it says, "We are going to go to Mexico for 4 days, and we are going to work together on building a house for people who need help with building their home." And Sam was like, "What? That is not a bachelor party." And like the Israelites, you know, they moved into freedom. They tried to go this other route, and they grumbled.
You can imagine what happens when people start reading down about the bachelor party and they're like, we're going where? We're going to do what? They started to grumble. And all kinds of excuses started to come in. I'm pretty busy. I've got this work thing. 4 days is a little long. If it was three, I'd probably be in. And a whole bachelor party started to disintegrate. People are like, I'm not going to do it. The person who was imagining this, who wanted to abstain from our cultural addiction to what it means to be a real man, that's what he was abstaining from. And he tried to do it. He tried to go this route. And it got hard. And friends, when we try to interrupt cycles of violence, when we try to abstain from things, this is going to be hard. People started to tell him. And he started to wonder, why don't we just go to Vegas? What happens there stays there. No one will ever know. And eventually, they found it within themselves. At least a few of them did. Not everybody's going to make the trip. But a few of them made their way down to Mexico. And this is what a bachelor party looks like. I believe that our efforts to reach in love are something like this. Fasting and abstinence from the script that society says you're supposed to be like this. And I don't know what it means for you. Some of you might need to have a bachelor party that looks something like this. Some of you might need to creatively interrupt by abstaining and fasting from things that we've never imagined. I don't know what it is for you, but I know that God is calling all of us to stay in love with God and our neighbors in these kinds of creative forms of resistance and interruption. The poet D.H. Lawrence writes, "Are you willing to be sponged out, erased, canceled, made nothing? Are you willing to be made nothing, dipped in oblivion? If not, you will never really change." Friends, the good news of God's liberating love isn't ever a quick fix. Transformation doesn't happen through a 24-hour fast or abstaining from chocolate during the season of Lent. The way of fasting and abstinence isn't something we turn off and on. It's a way of life. It feels to me like it's a way of following Jesus. Because we all know that everyone has pain inside. That imaginary wounds we continue fighting to hide. And so this day, may our lives surrender to the God of love as we gather at this feast in celebration of this deep truth that indeed we are human and we are love and God pulses within us all. May the people say amen.
I'm gonna live so God can use me anywhere, Lord, anytime. I'm gonna live so God can use me anywhere, Lord, anytime. Take it, Melissa.
I'm gonna work so God can use me anywhere, Lord, anytime. I'm gonna work so God can use me anywhere, Lord, anytime.
I'm gonna pray so God can use me.
God can use me.